The following program isn't intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners and comes to you from the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Federson, and what is that program? It is The Independent, the Indie Week. And this week's issue is dated August the 7th of 2025. All right, and here we go. And we'll start in Durham, as we have a couple of large articles. First, from the Durham City Council meeting that occurred on Monday, the developer has pulled a controversial Heritage Square rezoning request. Sterling Bay, owners of the Heritage Square Shopping Center in the historic Hayti neighborhood, opted to withdraw their application to rezone that property after 3 years of intense negotiating and community engagement with residents and stakeholders. The council voted 5-2 in favor of accepting the withdrawal, with Councilors Nate Baker and Adriana Freeman voting no. Sterling Bay could still build on the land without rezoning it, or they could come back to the council with a new zoning request in 6 months. They purchased the 10-acre parcel in 2022, and the company planned to build a massive life sciences facility, hundreds of apartments and retail space on the site, estimated to produce $190 million in annual economic impact, with 1,500 new jobs at an average salary of $80,000, according to Jamie Schwedler, an attorney with Parker and Poe, who represented that project on behalf of Sterling Bay. But opponents said that local residents wouldn't be the ones who benefited from the promised growth, and that the planned complex with the tallest building at 10 stories would tower over the surrounding neighborhood. Residents pushed the developer to include more benefits to locals, including scholarships to area colleges and other monetary donations, conference space for community use, and concessions to a nearby church. Opponents also fear what could become of the site if Sterling Bay wins a rezoning and the ability to build higher, but foregoes its redevelopment plans and instead sells the property off for maximum profit. When first purchased the property, when Sterling Bay first purchased, the group intended to build on the site, quote, by right, a process that doesn't require City Council approval. But after a preliminary site evaluation, the developers discovered they would not be able to build the project parking garage underground as they had intended due to bedrock. Building higher triggered the need for a rezoning, which the developers requested in 2024, putting the project at the mercy of the City Council and giving the Hayti community leverage to negotiate additional community benefits. The specifics of the proposal have morphed several times through months of intense negotiations between various factions of the Hayti community and Sterling Bay. At its core, the project included a 10-story office building, 2 8-story life science facilities, 27,000 square feet of retail space, and roughly 400 residential units. The project would have been completed in multiple phases over the next few years. Heritage Square rezoning was originally slated for a vote on June 16th, but the applicant requested a continuance to conduct more community engagement. The case came back before Durham City Council Monday night. Nearly 100 people showed up to represent their faction of the opposition party. A tense energy hung in the air as residents awaited the fate of Heritage Square. After a public hearing on the rezoning opened, Schwedler shared a detailed 16-minute recap of the events preceding last night's vote, receiving snickers and jeers from the audience. But her closing statement caught the entire chamber by surprise. Schwedler said, "We stand by what we tried to do for Hayti community and the process that we led. It was genuine. It's not like any you've seen before, and I stand by the integrity. We mourn the loss of what could have been had this community been willing to accept millions of dollars for its young students and its black entrepreneurs and the opportunity they could have afforded on the corridor. The reality is that denial does not help the people of Hatay, but neither does 2 hours of public discourse when it's clear the writing is on the wall. And then Schwedler, on behalf of Sterling Bay, requested to withdraw the proposal. Gasps, whispers, and murmurs echoed through the packed chambers of City Hall. Mayor Leonardo Williams had to repeatedly ask for order in the chamber to quell the audience's fervent response to Schwedler's announcement. Some council members felt that the drove of community members who showed up to the meeting should be allowed to speak rather than hold their peace. Councillor Freeman made the case, with an upvote from Councillor Cook, that the multitude of ideas that residents shared through this engagement process for Heritage about how community development should work was worth placing in the public record, though a public hearing for future, through a public hearing for future consideration. And Freeman said there was a lot said in the town hall meetings, and I'd hate for council not to hear those points. They had a very specific request about how the development should happen, how a developer coming in should be like a neighbor, making sure the developer was in partnership with the community. This will come back at some point, whether in a different format or different owners. With nearly 40 public speaker cards on the dais, and another development case still on the docket, other councillors offered to hear the community out at a later date and moved forward with the vote to withdraw the Heritage application. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton said without a project to oppose, hosting a public hearing was moot. What are they speaking in opposition to? Middleton asked. If the applicant has withdrawn their case, there's nothing to uphold. While we may lament and be upset about not being able to speak tonight, what is the ultimate victory you were looking for? The withdrawal is a reflection of the efficacy of your organizing. They have raised the white flag. They have yielded. Over the last 3 years, Sterling Bay hosted over 53 stakeholder meetings with a collection of political action committees, educational institutions, government entities, and neighborhood associations, steadily compiling a list of potential community proffers. Several community meetings have been held at St. Mark AME Zion Church on Roxborough Street, which sits adjacent to Heritage Square. At a meeting on July 24th, hosted at St. Mark, Sterling Bay laid out explicit community benefits they were willing to meet. A number of folks questioned how the developers would be held accountable for those proffers. There are few avenues for Hatay, the community, or the city council to do so, but Sterling Bay had agreed to commit to several proffers via a land covenant, which allow a landowner to legally bind requirements to the deed of property. And they are as follows. Create a $55,000 scholarship to North Carolina Central University and another one to Durham Tech with a request that both institutions give priority to students from the Hatay community. A $55,000 donation to Hatay Promise Community Development Corporation, serving as the first private donation to this organization, which has $10 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds for community improvement projects. Provide 5,000 square feet of affordable retail for local business at a 50% discount from market rent. That's an approximately an $800,000 rent subsidy over 10 years. Provide parking for St. Mark at 100 spaces on Sunday, plus 4 events per year, and 200 spaces for Hatay Heritage Center, plus 8 events per year. Evaluate the diversion of Heritage Square stormwater away from St. Mark's property, if allowed by the city and Department of Transportation. Provide 2,500 square feet of conference space free to the community, including to NC Central and Durham Tech, for their real estate and workforce development programs, among others. Create guidelines and pre-blasting surveys for St. Mark, as well as posting money to an escrow account in the event blasting causes direct injury to the church site. Commit to a community process for historical signage to honor the Hatay community. Provide a 1-acre outdoor public gathering space and an intention to include at least 15% minority and women-owned business participation in the project over the full build-out. Before voting to accept Sterling Bay's withdrawal Monday night, Williams urged community leaders to pull together a planning meeting to create a vision for Heritage Square in the Fayetteville corridor. In 2024, Durham City Council granted $10 million, some of which came from American Rescue Plan Act funding, to Haiti Promise Community Development Corporation. That's an initiative that grew out of the Heritage Center and was spearheaded by Angela Lee, the center's previous director, to jumpstart revitalization for the Fayetteville Street Corridor project. "I'm so curious," said Williams. "If not this, then what? It can't be all no and then don't respond with something. We got to have something. I don't want to drive down to NC Central and continue to see the same thing. I want this to be one of the most vibrant neighborhoods in the city of Durham, and right now, I don't know what that looks like." In this call to action, Williams specifically named Anita Scott Neville, director of Haiti Reborn, a nonprofit organization founded in 2021 with ambitions to revitalize the historic community through economic investment, and the lead organizing force behind opposition to the Sterling Bay rezoning. Neville, a lifelong resident of Haiti with extensive experience in public service and community organizing, has been front and center throughout the negotiations, speaking at city meetings, community engagement sessions, and local forums. And Neville said at the April 8th Planning Commission meeting, in which the commission voted 10-0 against Sterling Bay's proposal, quote, "The greatest harm that has resulted from this whole process has been the blatant disregard for the value of this acreage to the preservation of Haiti and for the sovereignty and resolve of its citizens to resist gentrification, invasion, and erasure of our community. Longtime residents of the neighborhood have waited decades for substantial reinvestment in Haiti. Some feel they have been burned too many times by the false promise of urban renewal to trust the intentions of outside developers and worry that the ripple effect of large projects like the one proposed by Sterling Bay would cause additional harm." Larry Hester told the Indy in 2022, "When you bring in large developments, it changes the community, and it changes rapidly. People aren't looking at what the effects are and how quickly these effects will take place." Hester, along with his wife Denise, are longtime owners of the neighboring Phoenix Square and Phoenix Crossing shopping centers on Fayetteville Street. Redevelopment for Heritage Square would likely increase the property values of nearby homes and businesses like the Hesters, forcing them to raise rents on tenants who are 90% black. And Hester said, "Durham is responsible for the destruction of Haiti and has a duty to rebuild." Although the developers have estimated almost $200 million in economic impact, Haiti residents have little faith that the high salary life science jobs created will be accessible to neighbors, and that the financial boon will help restore a community that was ravaged by urban renewal initiatives in the mid-1900s that demolished homes and severed Haiti's connectivity, crippling an economic engine once known as Black Wall Street. Henry McCoy, a professor and economic development expert who recently served in the Biden administration as the director of Office of State and Community Energy Programs, founded Haiti Reborn with the belief that the once flourishing Haiti neighborhood could be rejuvenated through strategic investment and a comprehensive plan that prioritized the input of residents. Heritage Square is not the only development that Haiti Reborn has been contending with in the neighborhood. In 2022, the Durham Housing Authority rejected a plan spearheaded by McCoy and Haiti Reborn to build a multi-purpose project on the site formerly known as Fayette Place, a block away from Heritage Square. On June 13th, Haiti Reborn held a Spirit of Juneteenth block party at Hittite Heritage Center that doubled as a community rallying cry to gather supporters to stand in opposition of the rezoning. Neville and many others were unsure then about the ultimate fate of Heritage Square, and he told the Indy, the developers will still own the land, the city council will still be the city council, but we, the people, will either bear the burden or the benefit of what happens at Heritage Square. 3 days later, the city council elected to postpone the vote on Heritage until last night, after the council returned from summer break. Well, now, it's unclear what the next step is. Residents and city officials will have to go back to the drawing board to create a vision for Heritage Square that is sustainable and drives the economic impact Hittite residents have long sought from the district. Heritage Square has struggled to maintain its viability since being built in 1985. The shopping center was funded through a variety of sources, including private real estate companies, city loans, 23 individual investors, and a coalition of black churches and community groups, according to a 2006 article from the News and Observer. During the 1990s, the city of Durham relocated its housing and community development department offices into Heritage Square to prop up the operation. Andy Rothschild, owner of real estate firm Scientific Properties, purchased that property in 2006 with a bold vision to revitalize that shopping center by reconnecting the district with Durham's Black Wall Street on Parrish Street, and the building services and amenities like retail spaces, an outdoor basketball court, and a performance stage that the Hittite residents could get behind. Those plans never materialized. Rothschild moved to New York City 2 years later. Heritage Square remained sparse for decades. Recently, the shopping center was notably home to Food World, an international grocery store stocked with a unique and eclectic variety of goods, and Pelican's Snowballs, a shaved ice shop. Both stores closed in 2023, a final death knell in this version of Heritage Square shopping center experiment, and the property has been vacant since. Durham is struggling to reimagine the portfolio of outdated malls and shopping centers that anchor many downtown neighborhoods. For example, Northgate Mall, shops at Lakewood, Wellens Village, and Heritage Square, which all have the potential to transform the communities they reside in. But how do you decide when an imperfect project is better than a concrete wasteland? Councillor Baker told Indy about Heritage Square last June. It's not like we want that parking lot sitting empty. It's not like we want Northgate parking lot sitting empty either. But I think with the way Durham is growing, we need to be smarter about developing and urbanizing truly in the best way that we can. What will actually get built on the site now that the proposal from Sterling Bay is off the table, at least for the foreseeable future? Well, the developers could sit on the land or sell it to another group that, as Schwedler suggested, might be less amenable to Hittite's requests. Could North Carolina Central University, a tentpole in the Hittite community, take ownership of the project, given their desire to expand their campus? McCoy says that some folks believe this withdrawal by Sterling Bay is merely a tactic to delay until after upcoming elections for Durham's mayoral seat and three council seats. Should incumbents up for re-election this fall make it back to the dais with their seats secured, an affirmative vote for a controversial development project becomes less politically threatening. Last night's win might be more like a rain delay, leaving the players to finish what they started at a later date. But McCoy has faith that in the meantime, an earnest collaboration between city officials and community leaders could yield results that satisfy Hittite residents. He sees the small area plan approach that was deployed in Walltown for Northgate Mall's possible redevelopment as a worthy blueprint for how Heritage Square could move forward. And he said, time is not neutral, recalling the teachings of Martin Luther King Jr. It can be used for the good or can be used for the bad. It can be used constructively or unconstructively. So it is on our charge to use that time constructively and figure out what we need. And next, from the weekend's State of Durham Town Hall. Over the weekend, four of Durham's government leaders gathered in the library auditorium to talk over some of the city and county's ongoing challenges and successes in a conversation moderated by Kids Voting Durham and Independent's own Justin Laidlaw. A recording of the full panel with County Commission Chair Nita Alam, City Council Member Javiera Caballero, State Representative Marcia Morey, and School Board Chair Bettina Umstead will be posted by Kids Voting Durham. In the meantime, here are our four biggest takeaways from the two-hour conversation. One, Durham's debate about development and character will continue to be a defining issue as the local election ramps up. None of the panels are on the ballot this fall, but that doesn't mean that no one has taken advantage of the opportunity to press some flesh. Indy spotted three of the six candidates for the Ward 1 City Council seat work in the room, including Andrea Casals, Matt Kopeck, and incumbent Adriana Freeman. Mayoral challenge Pablo Friedman found a perch at the very top of the stands, and incumbent school board members Natalie Beyer and Wendell Tabb showed face, although they're not on the ballot this year. Those city council candidates are sure to discuss the rate of development, which is always a hot election topic in an area that has seen insane growth in recent years. In one of the most charged moments of the afternoon, Anita Scott Neville of Hayti Reborn got a round of applause from the audience for asking Caballero about the upcoming city council vote on the Hayti Square development. And Scott Neville said the comprehensive plan for Durham highlights equity and community voice in how our city grows, yet the voting history of our elected council members reveals a propensity for approval of the goals of interloping developers, said Scott Neville. How do city council members think about, talk about, reconcile that disparaging reality between the plan for the city and the actions of the council members? Caballero, in her response, highlighted the urban growth boundary in Durham's comprehensive plan, saying, "We want all development to fall inside that urban boundary because we don't want to sprawl out. Everything on the inside of that line is going to densify because if you're not going out, you've got to go up. Those are your two choices. Or you stifle your growth. I understand that is uncomfortable for residents because it means our urban environment is going to change." Number two, everyone wants to see Durham Public Schools succeed. Umstead, recently re-elected to DPS board chair, perhaps put it best in her opening statement about her priorities for the year. Umstead said, "Some of them are not as exciting, like operating efficiently. We're really doing a lot of work to make sure we're running smoothly. Students are getting to school every day, they're getting fed, and people are paid. It may seem like a low bar, but functionality is the name of the game for a district that has, per the superintendent's own comments, struggled with, quote, forced errors over the past few years, reneged staff raises, inconsistent school bus service, and a prolonged spat with its educators' union." Alam pointed out the county has continued to increase its funding for DPS over the past 5 years, ending up at $224.5 million. Contribution to the district this year, that's a $13 million increase from the previous. The city doesn't directly support the school district, but Caballero said that getting high schoolers to use the city's fare-free bus system is one of the best solutions to the district's ongoing transit crisis. Getting more high schoolers on those buses and making sure they run on time, she said, will help lower the transit costs and the bus costs for our school system so that we can make sure our elementary-aged kids have more reliable bus service. Caballero also shouted out that the city's early stage bus rapid transit project, which is still lagging behind similar programs in Raleigh and Chapel Hill. She said, "I really want Durham to get ahead of Raleigh," she said, "because that is something that gives me deep joy." Number three, Durham will continue to feel Trump's agenda. Last month, the public schools worried about losing $3 million in funding when the Trump administration temporarily froze some funds for review. The funds have since been released, but the triangle still has been particularly hit hard by cuts to USAID, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Veterans Affairs, and higher education. All levels of Durham government have been struggling to respond to the administration's aggressive use of federal powers, but the immigration crackdown was the most visible part of the agenda last month when both Alam and Caballero mobilized to the Durham courthouse last month in response to Siembra, North Carolina's report that ICE agents had been spotted. Caballero highlighted that community response as one of the only things that Durham really can do at this point. Quote, "This isn't just on electeds, it's on our community. What's going to happen to our community is actually quite terrifying, and so when I say we're going to have to put our bodies on the line, it's not hyperbole. I think that's what it's going to take." Alam urged Durhamites to continue to, quote, "witness, record, document what's happening to make sure our community stays as safe as possible and that there is a record of these incidents." And number four, and the state legislature is not coming to the rescue of progressives. Maury, by her own admission, is a bit of a Debbie Downer. "Glad to be here. I hope I don't depress you," she told the crowd at the outset. North Carolina is a solidly purple state. Voters in 24 opted for Trump in the same election that they picked Democrat Josh Stein for governor and Jeff Jackson for attorney general. About 40% of North Carolina's voters are unaffiliated, 30% registered Democrat, and 30% are registered Republicans. Despite that, Republicans hold both chambers of the legislature, which Moore called a product of extreme gerrymandering. She also described Democrats as having, quote, "shot ourselves in the foot" last week when Mecklenburg area representative Carla Cunningham joined with Republicans to overturn Governor Stein's veto of a bill that requires local sheriffs to work more closely with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in its brutal or ongoing crackdown. Throughout this conversation, Maury listed bills on gun safety and subsidized housing for teachers that didn't, quote, "see the light of day" because they don't have Republican support. In short, ultra-blue Durham should not expect to see much help from the state anytime soon. Caballero, though, said there may be opportunity for bipartisanship around transit and housing because even the red areas of North Carolina are seeing rapid growth. She said, "Johnston County will be the fastest growing county in North Carolina between now and 2055. They're facing the same affordable housing and transit issues, so those are the very few places that we might see some real movement between Republicans and Democrats." And next, a short article. PBS, North Carolina announces voluntary separation agreements and a hiring freeze to most of its permanent employees, announced the network today. Their headquarters in RTP, with employees at 12 stations across the state, due to recent federal funding cuts totaling almost $9 million, the organization will undergo, quote, "a reorganization through reduction program that is part of cost-cutting measures designed to minimize the potential scope of involuntary staff reductions," they said in a press release. Additionally, the organization, which is the third largest member station in the United States, will enact both, quote, "revenue-generating and cost-saving measures," and these include reductions in non-personnel expenses, a hiring freeze, and eliminating vacant positions. The move comes after the nonprofit Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, announced it was shutting down Friday after Congress stripped it of $1.1 billion in a package of spending cuts passed last month. CPB helps support PBS and National Public Radio, as well as more than 1,500 local public radios and television stations across the country. For PBS North Carolina, this means an annual loss of nearly $5 million. Quote, support that has been instrumental to provide educational program and critical emergency communications infrastructure, states the release. David Crabtree, the CEO of PBS North Carolina, said, we did not create this. It was dictated by Congress. Nonetheless, we will play the hand we're dealt and continue to be good stewards of our budgets. Last year, PBS North Carolina received more than $29 million in total revenue, according to its website, while the bulk of that, 52%, came from private donors via grants and individual gifts. 35% came from the state, and federal support comprised 13%. PBS North Carolina originally launched as WUNC in 1955, 12 years before the CPB was established. Its four broadcast channels include PBS North Carolina, Rootle, 24/7 PBS Kids Channel, and the Explorer Channel. It also offers in-person engagement opportunities and digital-first social and online content, and provides the infrastructure for the state's emergency services communications. Crabtree said, while this is a time of fundamental change for public media, it reminds us of our deep roots in the communities we serve. Today, PBS North Carolina still belongs to the people of this state, and our commitment is unwavering. Now, our very long-form article today by Justin Laidlaw is about a name that I cannot pronounce, but I will try, Bruce DePeissler, D-E-P-Y-S-S-L-E-R. Forgive me if I'm getting that wrong, but I'm going to call Mr. DePeissler by that pronunciation. He led NCCU's Campus Echo for 26 years, and he's retiring. That's North Carolina Central. Campus Echo, the student newspaper, plastered across the newsroom there as a collection of laminated, yellowing editions of the paper. Dozens of student journalism award plaques and the photos of former Echo staff on campus, at cookouts, and on team road trips. A sign at the top of the door reads, "The Danita M. Smith Newsroom," dedicated in honor of a former student who was tragically shot and killed. During the school year, the Campus Echo, housed inside the Ferrison Newton Communications Building, is home base for aspiring writers, photographers, and video editors. Each student is charged with narrating life at NC Central, in Durham, and at times in the rest of the world. And leading the charge for the past 26 years has been NCCU professor and student advisor Bruce DePeissler. A well-traveled military brat with a background in anthropology and a host of odd jobs, DePeissler has an innate ability to adapt new skills and meet people where they are. In the classroom, he was no drill sergeant. With his shaggy hair and glasses hanging around his neck, DePeissler would float to the classroom, cool, calm, and collected, offering pearls of wisdom without overbearing. DePeissler not only built an award-winning program, but shaped generations of students, including yours truly, that's Justin Laidlaw, who say DP, as he is affectionately called by the Central community, wasn't just their professor, but a father figure who made the Echo feel like home and its staff like family. After two decades, DePeissler retired this summer, and NC Central is trying to find a replacement. Calvin Hall, chair of NCCU's Mass Communication Department, says, I'm not expecting anything less than Bruce. Now we just got to figure out who's going to build on the foundation that he laid. Before settling down at Central, DePeissler lived a nomadic lifestyle. His father, U.S. Air Force colonel, took the Peisler around the world, California, Washington, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., North Dakota, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. After a few years, I'd always go, aren't they supposed to be somewhere else? He says. As a young adult, he maintained a variety of odd jobs, like ice cream truck driver, janitor, restaurant manager. He even followed a girlfriend home to France, where he worked on a tourist barge in the Canal de Bourgogne. The culmination of these experiences was a natural curiosity and an adaptability, traits that would serve him well years later when he fell into a journalism career. He planted roots in Texas in 1976, where he earned a double bachelor's degree in history and philosophy, a master's in communication and development, and a Ph.D. in cultural anthropology, a fitting field of study for a globetrotter. He taught communications, sociology, and anthropology at universities in Texas and Ohio. He landed at Carrboro in 1994. His wife at the time, a communications researcher from Chihuahua, Mexico, got offered a job at UNC Chapel Hill. De Peisler got hired as an adjunct professor and sought part-time work while finishing his dissertation. An ad for production help at an alt-weekly called The Independent and its progressive bent caught his attention. He nagged a manager enough times that they hired him on to help outline the paper. I have to get to the next page here. It's a long article, as I said. There we go. De Peisler says, they're cranking out the stories on the paper, and I'd run it through this waxing machine and stick it on these boards. When it was all done, I'd drive the boards down to the press. It was pretty substantial back then. 2 years later, as he neared the end of his dissertation on influential communications campaigns throughout Indian history, he was back on the job hunt. He applied for a teaching position at the University of the Incarnate Word in San Antonio. The administration saw he worked at the Independent and inquired about him leading the school's student newspaper, the Logos, too. Despite having a newspaper job on his resume, De Peisler had never written more than a few articles, much less led a newsroom. Steve Shule, the co-founder of the Independent, tried to convince De Peisler to stick around. Before I'm packing up, he recalls, Steve comes to me and says, you know, you don't have to leave. You can stay. We can keep you working here. And at that time, I'd written a few book reviews and stuff for the Indy, but I said, nah, I'll go. He liked living in the Triangle, but was enticed by the challenge. He took the job in Texas and soon started to make his imprint on the newspaper program. Tricks of the trade, like Associated Press style and how to construct a lead, L-E-D-E, were simple enough for De Peisler, used to a life of picking up odd jobs and new skills, to learn. And his background in anthropology and communications meant he understood people and how to tell a story. In a short time, La Logos was bringing home regional awards from the Society of Professional Journalists. But the program also ruffled feathers with higher-ups. John Tedesco, now an editor at the Houston Chronicle, worked for the student newspaper De Peisler's first year. Tedesco's stories on sexual misconduct by faculty and a university president busted trying to smuggle cigars out of Cuba caused a firestorm. Administration threatened to fire De Peisler, he recalls, but he stood his ground. Soon after, another door opened for De Peisler. NCCU, a historically black university in Durham, just 15 miles away from Carrboro, was searching for an advisor to lead the campus echo. The next section is titled The Dude. When De Peisler arrived in Durham in 1999, he made an immediate impression on his students. Before they ever learned about AP style, the students couldn't help but notice their new professor's own style. Fonte Coleman, a musician and member of a hip-hop group, Little Brother, who had graduated from Central in 2001, says he used to wear these shirts and wear his sandals with his toes out and shit. Coleman, an English major with a propensity for creative writing, found his way to the Campus Echo, where he became arts and entertainment editor. He likens DePeisler to the dude, Jeff Bridges' iconic character from the film The Big Lebowski. Coleman says he just seemed like that cool professor that probably smoked a lot of weed. My first impression was this dude is not your typical kind of buttoned-up, stodgy professor. Despite his laid-back demeanor, Coleman and others say DePeisler brought out the most in his students. Quote, he was a nurturing presence. He always looked out for all of us on the Echo. He went hard for us, and we went hard for him. Resource to produce the paper were limited in the early years. When DePeisler took over, he said, the Echo was zero. It was nothing. A singular table that sat in the middle of the room bowed from the weight of the one desktop computer the program had, and there was no staff camera. Whoever had their own camera was the photographer. Students worked lean and scrappy to produce the paper, developing their own film photographer and dropping off the paper layout at the printing press themselves. These circumstances did not deter DePeisler or his students. Again, as he had done at Incarnate Word, DePeisler quickly developed another award-winning program. Those early achievements gave him leverage to pressure the Student Affairs Office for more resources. Advertising revenue started flowing, too. Soon, the Campus Echo could afford better computers and more cameras, and their growing reputation reverberated across campus. Sheena Johnson Cooper, class of 2005, became interested in joining the Echo staff after a professor took notice of her writing skills and encouraged Cooper to further explore her talents. She says, you heard those stories, and you walk in the Echo, and you see the newspapers plastered on the wall, you see the awards plastered on the wall, and you just got this feeling like this is something special, and it just drew people in from all walks of life. Everybody has a story to tell, and the Echo is your playground to do it. But also, like at Incarnate Word, the Echo, under DePeisler's guidance, provoked the administration, and again, DePeisler stood behind his staff and their reporting. As the rare female sports reporter, Cooper spent hours interviewing players and coaches who referred to her with terms like babe. She says DePeisler encouraged her to lean into those challenges and be powerful and unapologetic. Together, they confronted administration and coaching staff, and Cooper persuaded them to ensure student journalists were treated with respect while on assignment. Years later, the Echo came into conflict with administrators again. While investigating the sudden departure of a vice chancellor at the school, amid rumors and accusations, Echo reporters were stonewalled by administrators and school police at every turn. Staff wrote at the time, regardless, the Campus Echo will continue to search for the truth in every story. But perhaps the most significant class was over Danita Smith, a former staff photographer who was shot and killed in 2007 by a woman described as a jealous ex-girlfriend of Smith's fiancé, Roni Camille, who was the Echo editor at the time and had worked with Smith, led a campaign to name the newsroom in honor of Smith, but the administration pushed back. Camille says, I remember DP spoke at Danita's funeral on our behalf, and it was so beautiful. I spoke at the memorial service on campus, and I made an announcement we would be looking into renaming the newsroom after Danita, and there was a whole applause, but the administration was sitting in the front row, and none of them applauded. Camille, with DePeisler's support, rallied his peers to make the name change anyway. Under DePeisler, the Campus Echo won a staggering 300 student journalism awards. DePeisler and Echo staff launched the Bull City Doc Squad, a rotating team of students who made films like Upbuilding Whitted, which is pivotal in bringing attention to the historical significance and disrepair of Durham's first high school for African-American students. There would not be a mass communication department at NCCU if not for the Echo, says Hall, the department chair. Former staff, some of whom still return to the nest to support the next flock of Eagle reporters, have gone into teaching, public relations, community development, music, and less, yes, even local journalism, like Rashawn Rucker, class of 2003, who won an Emmy Award in 2008 for documentary photography at the Detroit Free Press. And on July 12th, DePeisler received one more distinction. Durham Mayor and fellow Eagle Leonardo Williams proclaimed Dr. Bruce J. DePeisler Day during a Zoom call with more than 70 former students and colleagues brought together by the clarion call of their former advisor and surrogate father's retirement. Camille says, he built a powerhouse. He built something we can all look back and be proud of. In 2001, DePeisler, the newsroom dad, piled the Campus Echo family into a passenger van for a trip up to D.C. to visit the USA Today offices. That van was as lively as the Echo. Coleman was doing his hip-hop thing, as DePeisler describes it, and DP, students say, was driving with the lead foot of a taxi driver during rush hour. Seeing USA Today was a shock for students who had so far only experienced the Echo newsroom. Walking through the newsroom, Coleman says, I was like, this just seems really boring and really white. Reporters sat in sterile cubicles and there was no music playing over the PA. The visit crystallized a feeling DePeisler and the Echo students already knew they had something special back in Durham. Rarely was there a dull moment inside the Echo, especially in that first decade of DePeisler's reign, before working remotely became common and the Echo still produced a physical paper. If staff weren't in class or asleep in the dorms, they were in the newsroom. Music was always in the air, either from students like Danny Hooley, who loved a good reggae tune, or from demo CDs that record labels sent for review. Reporters chipped away at stories or lounged in the room, laughing and joking about college life. At the center of it all was the eccentric, mild-mannered, hippie anthropologist D.P., or his D.P.-ness, D.P.-er, or El D.Perino, if you're not into that whole brevity thing. Students fed off the creative energy. Producing the paper was a team effort, especially on deadline. In addition to the daily happenings on the campus, the Echo covered important cultural touchstones like 9/11 and the election of Barack Obama. The headline read, Obama Reaches Mountaintop. Students say they never saw DePeisler lose his cool, apart from occasional frustration over deadlines. He was more traffic cop than probation officer, Coleman explains, providing guidance for student journalists to find their own way, rather than imposing his own. Mike Williams, class of 2003 and former editor, said he let us be who we are, but we had guardrails, and the more comfortable we got with how we were fit into this idea of putting out a news product, he would remove the guardrails. As one of his many former jobs, DePeisler worked as a chain restaurant manager in Texas, a role that helped shape his leadership style years later at the Echo. He says, it is a weird balancing act of giving people the room they need to do the job. You can't be too heavy-handed. The thing in restaurants was always like, look, this is a bitch. I know it is. I didn't invent capitalism. This is what we're stuck with. Let's do the best we can and enjoy ourselves. Many former students say DePeisler was like a father figure to them. Students often brought in their kids. They weren't allowed in class, and child care was financially prohibited, so DePeisler opened up the Campus Echo as an unofficial daycare. Cooper says the Echo office was home away from home. The staff were like family, and DP was like dad. Kiki, daughter of former student Stacy Harden, class of 2005, grew up in that newsroom. A photo of Kiki beaming with joy during horseback riding lessons that DePeisler gifted her hangs right above his desk. He also taught Kiki photography and supported her gymnastics lessons. He says, we got attached. I was kind of like a substitute dad with her for a while. Another photo shows Coleman, his son, born while Coleman was a student at NCCU, and his son's mother, a fellow Eagle, at a staff picnic. DePeisler was one of the first people Coleman shared the news about his son with. the daycare tradition passed down through the years. Nada Mirgane, class of 23, and a former editor, still saw rugrats running around the newsroom, saying a lot of that is DP's doing, even down to the name of the newsroom, Danita M. Smith, being named after a student who was so tragically killed, shows the level of care that, like, it was always about the students. 5 years into his tenure at Central, De Peisler, the Globetrotter, flirted with taking a position at a small college in Lugano, Switzerland, teaching students, quote, like Romney's kids and the children of oil sheikhs. The school flew him to Switzerland for interviews and eventually offered him the job. When I came back, he says, the students here were just going, DP, you can't leave, man. That was the closest I came to leaving. That was a tough decision. He devoted, though, the next two decades to ECHO and its staff, cementing his legacy in the annals of NC Central history. And Hooley, a colleague of De Peisler's in the mass communication department since 2014, said, I mean, he stopped wearing sandals a long time ago, thank God, but those are some tough sandals to fill. His successor will have to make tough decisions about what direction to take the program and how to train students for an ever-changing industry, facing challenges the ECHO also faces, like artificial intelligence, fractured audience, and a glut of information and entertainment options. And Hall says, how do we interest students in what journalism has to offer as a profession, and then how do we deal with the challenge or opportunity, depending on how you look at it, what AI means in terms of that job? Because there's always going to be the responsibility that journalism has taken on as a profession to report, enlighten, and inform the masses of people. NCCU has narrowed down the search for De Peisler's replacement, but hasn't yet filled the role. He doesn't have plans to slow down in retirement, though. He is refocusing on documentary work and already has his next assignment, a film about Adrian Maldonado Jr., a young queer Latino man running for city council in Salisbury. De Peisler also plans to spend more time in Sierra Leone, where his wife, Katiatu, is from, and where the couple plans to adopt three children, mentor young professionals, and produce a documentary about the country's decade-long civil war. And he says, a lot of men really struggle with this, you know, their whole life is tied up with their work. My father was a good example. He just kept volunteering at the base for like 40 years after retirement. For De Peisler, packing up the ECHO office was like packing up the home your kids grew up in after you became an empty nester. He delayed the process, packing up a box or two and letting them sit for a week, contemplating what his next chapter might look like. On his last day, he pulled keepsakes off the wall, old photos, notes from students, a letter from former NC Central Chancellor Julius Chambers, and left most of the award plaques and old newspapers up for posterity. Sitting in the office alone, replaying the highlights in his mind as he soaked up the newsroom for the last time, tears slid down his face. That's the first time I really got emotional, he says. I was just in there on my own, like, damn, Hein, I just spent a quarter of a century in here. Well, now just 2 minutes remain for me, and I will just continue rambling through the Indie Week's Best of the Triangle awards, which come out each year, and we're still in the midst of Durham Awards, in which I will just name the winners in every category. And we've long since passed bars, entertainment, restaurants, etc. And we will now get on. Well, we're just finishing that up and just continue as long as time permits. And we'll start with the best mixologist. And the winner of that one is Will Swart from Alley 26. And the best local activist group is Bike Durham. The best nonprofit, TROSA, T-R-O-S-A. We know about them. The best kids nonprofit is the Emily Krzyzewski Center, Emily K. Best reason to love Durham County. Okay, this is this category. Best local band, Sylvan Esso. Best Local Influencer, Naomi Dix. Best Politician, Nida Alam. The Best Reason to Leave Durham County. They get votes for everything here. Housing Prices. The Best Use of Public Money, the winner of Durham Public Schools. The runners-up, the HERT program and the county library. Biggest waste of county money, charter schools and private school tuition vouchers from the General Assembly. And moving on, best barbershop, rock, paper, scissors. Best child care, the Schoolhouse of Wonder. Remember, these are all in Durham, Durham County. And best chiropractic practice is Carolina Pain and Performance. The best dental practice, Durham Pediatric Dentistry and Orthodontics. Best dermatological practice, Triangle Dermatology. The best gym, the Duke Health and Fitness Center. Best hair salon, rock, paper, scissors. Best holistic magazine, Duke Integrative Medicine. Best massage therapist, Haley at Aurora Flow. Best pediatric practice, Duke Pediatric Primary Care. Best physical therapy practice, Bull City Physical Therapy. How about the best spa? Blue Water at Briar Creek. Best dog veterinary practice, Eno Animal Hospital. Best cat veterinarian, the same. Best women's health practice, Chapel Hill, OBGYN. How about yoga studio? The award is for Blue Point. The best attorney. These, remember, readers' votes. Law offices of James Scott Farron. Best auto mechanic at Wasp Automotive. The best CBD and head shop, Magic Craft Bull City Magic. The best clothing consignment, Rumors. And that's about all for this issue. Oh, wait, I can get you the best dance studio, 9th Street Dance. Runners-up, Fred Astaire and Davis Dance Company. And I'll bet in just a moment we'll hear our amazing orchestra sounding out our theme song. Oh, yes, there it comes right now. And we will be back with you next week with the next edition of The Independent. We snuck them in. Anyway, John Fetterson will say so long for this week from the Indie Week. And you can find this as a podcast after our initial broadcast, as we do all of our independent. And you can also go to indieweek.com and see the entire issue, including stunning graphics and whatever else links they provide. So, Indie Week now says farewell to you, faithful listeners, for another week.